Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor of townhall.com, and I'm here today with
Alex Seitzwald, the National Journal.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with me today, Alex. Obviously a lot going on here in DC, and specifically, well, a lot or nothing going on in DC. The government is shut down. Mostly because Republicans want to use it as leverage to kind of try to extract concessions out of the Obama administration on their policy priorities. And I wanted to kind of chat with you on, obviously you've been doing some coverage of this, but first I wanted to talk about the distinction between tactics and actual strategy here. Now, President Obama last week, I believe, said that, you know, the tactics that the GOP are engaging in right now are unprecedented. No one ever tries to attach concessions to continuing resolutions. It's unprecedented to use the debt ceiling, as they're seemingly going to do next, to push this fight even further. And I think that that is largely incorrect. And I think that we're unfortunately seeing a lot of the media picking up this line that, you know, what the actual tactics of what the GOP are doing are unprecedented. And I'm not sure that that's true, and I want to get your take on this, but you see throughout history when there's a minority party in Congress opposing, you know, obviously what I would call the governing party, controlling the presidency and in this case controlling half of Congress, you've seen the minority party use budget battles and the debt ceiling as leverage to try and extract policy concessions from the governing party. And I think that there's an important distinction to be made between what the GOP is actually trying to get out of the Obama administration and the way in which they're trying to do that. And as far as I can tell, and I did a piece on this on Town Hall yesterday, the actual tactic of using the debt ceiling to try to extract concessions has a pretty well-established history. And I talked about there was an interesting showdown from 1985 to 1987, Democrats were a minority in Congress. While in 1986, they won the majority back in the Senate. But President Reagan, obviously, was in the White House. And the debt ceiling was raised 8 times in 3 years, which is President Obama on Tuesday yesterday talked about how we can't go through this every 3 months. That averages about one debt ceiling crisis every 3 months over the 1985 to 1987 period.
Yeah.
And so I think that we've seen this kind of governing by crisis before. What obviously we haven't seen is kind of the monolithic nature of the political parties right now. And we haven't seen, I think that the GOP's demands here are pretty ridiculous, and they're largely, you know, it's a Sisyphean task trying to push that boulder up against the White House. And so I think that the shutdown in general is a bad idea. I don't necessarily agree that the tactics by which they're trying to exercise leverage are out of the bounds of normal political operation.
Yeah, well, it's refreshing to hear you say that, I will say. And I think you're right. You know, I'll agree and disagree. I think you're right that this has been used in the past before several times. Speaker Boehner yesterday, I believe the bench said 27, or he had, you know, a long list, and there's even a fact sheet on his website where you can go down and see every time it's been used. What I think is different here is that while the debt ceiling has been used to extract concessions and to negotiate, it was always kind of a bit of an empty threat, and people understood that. There was never actually an attempt to shoot the hostage, if you will. And, you know, of course, if you're really serious about taking hostages, there's no point in doing it unless you're actually serious about shooting the hostage. But this seems like, from people that I've talked to and from what I've read, this seems like the first time that a political party is actually looking like they're ready to shoot the hostage. And you can, you know, talk to a lot of Republicans on the Hill, and they say default isn't really that big of a deal, or we won't default on October 17th.
Excuse me.
Bless you. And that, you know, this debt prioritization thing, which we could talk about in more detail, but doesn't really seem like a viable solution to me. So yeah, I think you're right that it's important to distinguish here. And the strategy is nothing new. The tactic in the broad sense is nothing new, but I think taking it as far as they have is new. And it might not seem like a big distinction, but I think it's a really important one. Because you're literally, you know, everyone agrees, John Boehner agrees, Republicans agree that we need to raise the debt ceiling. Except for maybe, you know, the Ted Yohos of the world, everyone agrees that default would be catastrophic for the not only our country, but the entire global economy. So to really threaten to shoot that, you know, to shoot that hostage, to really threaten to potentially have inflict, you know, catastrophic pain on the entire global economy, I think that is a new thing. You know, it's not just being used as a point of leverage, but it's actually being used as a hostage.
That might be the case. Now, I'm not the greatest historian on this in the world, but so I talked about the showdown in 1987, which the Democrats took back the Senate in 1986, and they used their control of the House and the Senate to pass a fairly large budget deal in conjunction with actually some Republicans in Congress. But President Reagan, you know, he threatened to veto it. He called it blackmail. The country actually ran up against the debt ceiling so closely that at a certain point in, I believe, November 1986, Reagan's Treasury Department raided the Social Security Trust Fund. Back then it was actually a trust fund. Raided the Social Security Trust Fund to extend the U.S.'s borrowing capacity. So I'm not sure that this time is any different than that, well, specifically that period of crisis governance when, you know, that we were running up pretty hard against the debt ceiling and, you know, the executive branch was saying, like, I am being held for ransom here. I have to sign what Congress has sent me or, you know, we're going to crash through the debt ceiling. I'm not sure about markets' reaction to what was going on in 1987. But certainly I would agree that right now, at least in the past 2 days, I think, the markets have been taking the hostage-taking situation fairly seriously. And I think that the Republicans would be wise to heed that. But I'm still not sure that this time is any different. You know, if we say that the GOP's attempt to use the debt ceiling as leverage this time is, you know, a form of, if they're like more serious about shooting the hostage, then we would have to say that for some reason the debt ceiling has never actually been a piece of leverage in the past, and either people were stupid for thinking that in the past the debt ceiling being used as leverage was actually serious, or that for some reason everyone knew, despite politicians actually making fairly major concessions towards the debt ceiling as leverage in the past.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I think some Republicans want to have it both ways. On one hand, they say default isn't that big of a deal and we won't default and, you know, we can prioritize our debt. And on the other hand, they're saying this isn't a point of leverage. You know, we are demanding things that Obama would never agree to under normal circumstances, like, you know, defunding Obamacare or delaying the individual mandate or whatnot. So I think there's always been a bit of, you know, dual, you know, two minds about the debt ceiling. But, you know, like one of the things that happened in 81, so this is before what you were talking about, but one of the concessions that House Democrats extracted was that they got a letter from President Reagan, you know, to each of the members saying that, yes, they should vote to raise the debt ceiling just as kind of political cover. And that seems like a pretty, you know, cosmetic thing here. But, and I'm not a historian either, and I'll preface that. But I think, you know, maybe one analog here would be that I think there's no doubt that Harry Reid started the kind of filibuster games, you know, with judicial nominations under Bush, and he deserves blame for that. And I think the filibuster is horrible. But that Mitch McConnell has taken it to a whole new level under Obama. So, you know, it has some historical precedent, but it's a matter of degree. And I think we're at a level of degree now that makes it something new and different. And one final point, and probably the most important thing that I would say about this, I never understand this argument that John Boehner is making, and, you know, Republicans are making, that, oh, well, Obama voted against the debt ceiling. You know, this has happened in the past. Just because your opponent did something bad doesn't give you license to do something bad. You know, if we agree it's bad, then you shouldn't do it just because your opponent did it. I mean, I guess it absolves you somewhat, but that doesn't seem like a defensible position to me. You know, if you punch me and I punch you, and then we both agree that punching each other is a bad idea, I shouldn't be able to punch you in return just because you punched me. If that makes sense. I mean, this whole if you think taking hostages is bad, then don't take hostages whether your opponent did it or not.
Right. I would agree. I don't think that President Obama. So this is actually I think an interesting thing to explore. I don't think that President Obama was ever sincere about raising the debt ceiling, right? And I think that President Obama himself would admit that it was. He's saying, you know, I was in Congress. I was just grandstanding. I was disingenuous. Don't pay attention to what I was doing back then, right? I think that the point that Republicans should make, and I'm not sure that they're making this, is, well, look, all we're doing is really grandstanding right now. You know, raising the debt ceiling is massively unpopular with the American people. We want to score political points by grandstanding about it and using it as leverage and what have you. But we all, I mean, I believe, and I think that most people do believe, that push comes to shove, the debt ceiling is going to get raised. It might be the fact that we're now in a unique situation where there's a larger chance than normal that we wouldn't raise the debt ceiling. But I don't think that I really don't think until we actually cross that threshold, I'm close to 100% certain that we're not going to, right? And I think that once we do get to the point where we do have an 11th hour deal, a Republican would be able to say this exact same thing that President Obama says, which is, I was just being disingenuous. I was grandstanding about it. Nobody likes, everybody likes using the debt ceiling to kind of say that our government is out of control. So, you know, don't believe what I said back then.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
and I think that President Obama should be able to say, it's okay for Republicans to grandstand about this because I did it once too.
That's fair. But there should always be, and I think there has always been, a sort of wink and a nod that even if you grandstand about it, you're still going to, you know, turn around and vote to raise it because we all agree that not doing so would be terrible. And I think that's what's different today, you know, at least if I'm to believe what Republicans say, tell reporters and say on TV and, you know, say publicly. I think there is a contingent, not all of them, but a contingent that honestly believes that not raising the debt ceiling would be a good thing, or at least not be a terrible thing. And I would have agreed with you that we would, you know, get an 11th hour deal 8 or 9 days ago before the government shut down. I was sure the government was not going to shut down until just a few days before it happened. They've come so close before so many times, and every time they've pulled out a last-minute deal at the 11th hour, I was sure we were going to get the same kind of thing. But I think we could be in uncharted territory here, and this could be a new thing where if you – you know, A, see taking the debt ceiling hostage as leverage that to extract something good, and B, you don't really see it as something that bad if you go over it, you're kind of in an ideal situation. If, you know, if you really believe that, then you can take this hostage and still shoot it and still not worry too much about doing it, to continue this analogy. So that's, I don't know. I mean, you know, then it comes down to, do we believe the Ted Yohos of the world when they say that it would actually bring stability to the market to lower the debt ceiling? I take them on their face value, but maybe I shouldn't.
Right. As far as I can tell, Republican leadership themselves has largely been saying, I guess, what you would say the right things are on the debt ceiling. You know, we have to raise it. We can't not raise it. Markets would panic. And I do think that you're right. It's troubling that there are people basically who exist like Ted Yoho who, you know, it could just be grandstanding, but he seems to be a little more invested in this idea than he should be able to.
And then the question is, how much control does the leadership really have at this point?
Yeah. That is another important question, which we'll get to, I think, in a little bit. But there is, it seems to be, a troubling undercurrent of a much larger contingent of the minority party who thinks that it wouldn't be a very big deal to hit the debt ceiling or to go past the debt ceiling. On the minor plus side, I think if it happened, the world would have a minor meltdown and it would never happen again, right?
I guess, yeah. I mean,
that would teach them their lesson. I'm not saying that we should, right. Obviously, but I think that Ted Yoho would change his opinion if we were to actually hit
the ceiling. You know, and I have to say that some of my liberal friends who, I disagree with, but I've heard several people say, you know what, if this is what they want, we should just do it, go over the cliff, and that'll teach them, break the fever, as right. Obama said. I think that's a really dangerous game. But if, yes. There's a chance it could come to that whether we want to or not.
Right. It's the same game, I think, that Republicans played with TARP. When the first vote on TARP failed, markets panicked. And they realized that they did not do the right thing, and they went back and had some minor changes to the legislation and passed it. I think that we would see, I think that the damage from hitting the debt ceiling would be way worse than the, couple hours that we didn't have a financial bailout program. But it would be kind of the same fundamental there, which is that, we liked grandstanding against TARP, but we had to pass it. We like grandstanding against the debt ceiling, but it always has to be raised. I think that you're right that you can't extract massive amounts of economic pain on a bunch of people just to teach some legislators a lesson.
Right, right. And I don't think that's the plan, and I don't think it should be the plan. But it is an interesting question. What happens when we do? And I would splash further cold water on that idea of doing it intentionally. Look at the government shutdown. That could have been a moment of fever breaking, of teaching lessons, and it has so far done none of that. If anything, it's just, entrenched people further. I think that that's something would be a different right. matter entirely, but it's just you just don't know how it's going to play out, and it's too risky to inflict harm on people, just teach them. It's sort of like if you wanted to teach your baby to stop playing with fire, let them burn themselves, and then that'll teach them. I don't know if that's really a smart parenting approach.
Right. That the shutdown question is very interesting. The polls are pretty bad for Republicans, but they're not bad enough, I think, for them to say, all right, this is urgent, we have to get back to work and kind of solve this. And I think that the actual effects of the shutdown are similar. People largely, I live in D.C., there's a park half a mile from me that's closed, but that's maybe the most major effect that I'm seeing from the shutdown. And it seems like most ordinary, let's not say ordinary, but the median American is not seeing all that large of an effect of the shutdown. And obviously members of Congress aren't particularly vulnerable to the worst effects of the shutdown. So they're kind of seeing, well, you can have constituents, writing into Republicans saying the shutdown's fine, I'm fine. And I think that that's being reinforced by the fact that nothing terrible has happened to the Republicans on the Capitol Hill. That's not to say that the shutdown's a good idea. I think the shutdown's a terrible idea. I think the Republicans had no strategy going into it. I think that their list of demands, or whatever you want to call it, that has evolved over the last 2 weeks from the Obama administration is completely incoherent. But it seems like the shutdown hasn't been bad enough to actually pull them urgently back to the negotiation.
Yeah, and I will blame the media here a little bit. I can't tell you how many stories I've read about the National Zoo, which is, yes, very tragic that I can't visit the National Zoo this week. But, there are real consequences for real people here. Or the World War II Memorial. That's horrible. World War II veterans should be able to visit their memorial, but we're talking there, and especially the longer this goes out and the more the effects pile up, there are people who aren't getting paychecks, who live paycheck to paycheck. There are people who aren't getting benefits. There are rape and domestic abuse centers that are being closed down. There's a science mission in Antarctica. You know, the U.S. supports the largest scientific mission in Antarctica. That might have to close down, and everyone who's there might have to pack their bags and come back, which just seems like an absurd thing. And, you know, so there are much bigger consequences here that I think have kind of not gotten the appropriate coverage that they should while we've been distracted by zoos and parks and such. And yeah, if you're a member of Congress, you know, you can designate your entire staff as essential and basically carry on, you know, with your life like it's nothing. And it's another issue of, you know, it's so common when you were saying like average American or median American. I think the more important distinction is the kind, you know, the more elite people who are in the media, who are in politics, who are the forming the conversation around this thing, are not affected much by the shutdown. You know, it's on the margins. It's the park. It's the zoo. But there are people in lower socioeconomic stratas who are being affected, you know. And then in the long term, kind of, you know, the how the government supports humanity level, civilization level endeavors like science, art, you know, medical research. These are really important things that are being shut down or impaired or, you know, otherwise stymied and will end up costing more and having long-term impacts. And they're just not getting enough attention, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wouldn't blame the media entirely. I think that the Obama administration strategy has been pretty terrible as well because, you know, the conservative media has largely been focused on what they call shutdown theater, which is, you know, like the National Park Service being adamant that open-air pieces of concrete have barriers around them so people can't visit.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, ludicrous. And that's kind of giving the media a sideshow story to look at, you know?
Right. If,
like, you know, World War II veterans trying to visit an open-air memorial and having a tiny little barricade in front of it is irresistible to the media. That's,
yeah,
that's partly on the White House, right?
No, that's true. And I've even seen people refer to them as barricades, as in, right, you know, Barry Obama.
Yes. But yeah, though, I don't think that the White House has had the greatest strategy either. But it might be partly because, like you and probably like me, they didn't actually think that this was going to happen. You know, they didn't realize that the government was going to get shut down, that there wouldn't be an 11th hour deal until we actually crossed that threshold. So they didn't really have a contingency plan in place. And, you know, there was that story, I think, in the Washington Times, you know, a park ranger said, "We've been instructed to make this as visibly painful as possible," which seems ludicrous again. And, you know, it's just one park ranger. Who knows what that person's agenda is. But still, the fact that those kind of stories are out there do hurt the Obama administration and definitely are disincentives to Republicans coming back to the table.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, you know, the talking points just write themselves. Like, Barack Obama refuses to negotiate as he kicks out World War II veterans from their own memorial. I mean, yeah. I don't think the White House is setting, you know, drawing maps of where the barricades go for the national park system.
Right. Yeah.
Or if so, they have way better things to post their time on. That's a scandal right there. But yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, there was that hot mic moment with Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, when Rand Paul kind of leaned into Mitch McConnell and said, "I don't think they poll tested this. I don't think they have any idea what they're doing." And I think he's probably right. I mean, you know, right now, it went from a situation where Republicans were making absurd demands and threatening to, you know, extract real harm on the American people unless Obama bowed to those demands. And now the message is, why won't Obama negotiate? And he is refusing to negotiate. I mean, I think that's it's a false talking point, but that's what politicians do, right? They say, you know, false talking points. And they didn't seem to foresee this. They don't seem to have any effective way to counter it. And yeah, I would definitely fault the White House communication shop here. This is the same thing on sequestration. They really blew that. You know, there's all this. It's going to be this huge catastrophic thing. It's going to be a nightmare, and it has been really terrible in a lot of ways, but because of the way they built it up, suggesting that the moment sequestration kicks in, you're going to start seeing the sky falling. That, of course, didn't happen. And then no one really believed it. And now, look, sequestration is completely not even being discussed. It's going to be baked into whatever CR finally passes. And the White House has already lost on that issue. It seems like they keep planning for these, catastrophic events not to occur that will up the rhetoric and, up the ante and in order to avert a deal at the last minute, but they don't actually think about what happens next, in case their plan didn't work. And I think that's happened both now with sequestration and the government shutdown. And who knows with the debt ceiling.
Yeah. And despite all this, Republicans are still being blamed more. The public does realize that
right. It
was a list of demands that Republicans had that, and those demands were unreasonable. The kind of repeal Obamacare thing, that was never going to happen. Even the 1 year delay of the individual mandate, that was never going to happen. And actually, as Republican demands have kind of gotten more incoherent, they faded into the background. Like you said, now people are asking, why isn't Obama coming to the table, rather than focusing on, and this might have, I don't know if this was planned, but this might be because, we're not even sure what would actually get Republicans to pass something at this point.
It was interesting today, Paul Ryan had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about how we end this crisis, and he didn't even mention the word Obamacare
right. Once.
The only mention of healthcare was to kind of dismiss it as a bargaining chip. So it's kind of faded away, and they don't even really seem to know what they want at this point.
Yeah. Now I wanted to get on to an article that you wrote a couple days ago on how some of what you might call good government reforms have kind of created this crisis that we're seeing, and that, leadership of political parties have less control over their members, basically because they're not able to buy them off. I have a couple doubts about that theory, but could you kind of explain that a little more in depth?
Yeah, so, I think there's a lot of reasons why we are where we are, but I think you can't overlook the fact that some of it came from unintended consequences, from reforms that were made with the best of intentions. Number one, getting rid of earmarks. Their earmarks are unseemly. They're borderline corrupt, sometimes outright corrupt. You can just ask Jack Abramoff. They fund things like the Bridge to Nowhere. But beyond that, they helped keep coalitions together. They helped, grease the skids for legislation to get through. All the best bills, all the biggest bills have been totally larded up with pork in order to get passed. I mean, I hate to use a fictional example, but I think it was brought home when in Lincoln, you saw these kind of backroom buy-offs, payouts, these dirty politics in the name of getting something good and big accomplished. And so I think without earmarks, it's just one less tool that leadership has in their quiver when they're going around trying to bring members onto their side. And, I'd add a couple more items to that. Just the kind of increased transparency, which seems great. We want to know more about what our lawmakers are doing. But the sausage-making process is gross and messy and easily exploitable for partisan gain. And so now when you have, things like Politico and all these different publications that have pulled back the curtain and opened up the process, I think it makes things harder to get done than when you could just go in a back room, hammer out a deal with the other leaders, go out, and then, lard them up with earmarks and get it passed through. Yeah. And one final thing I was particularly surprised to hear, I talked to Dennis Hastert about this, and he puts a lot of blame on McCain-Feingold, the campaign finance reform law. I'm a big advocate of campaign finance reform, but one of the unintended consequences of McCain-Feingold was that it got rid of soft money, which was essentially party money, and in doing that, it weakened the parties tremendously. But at least when the parties had the money, they had more say in the nomination process and which candidates got chosen, and they chose candidates that were electable. So they chose guys that had paid their due in the state party, and they were politicians. They had a feel for how the political process works. They weren't too far to the left or too far to the right. Like Ted Cruz never would have been elected. Dave Dewhurst, the guy who he ran against in the Republican primary, was just as conservative as Ted Cruz, but he was a politician, and that was enough to get him not elected. So it's an interesting, you know, kind of look. All these things that we thought were good, it's another lesson in unintended consequences, which happens a lot in, you know, Washington. You do something with the best of intentions, and then it comes back to bite you down the road.
Right. So here's a question. Do you think that some of these, you know, what we would call good government reforms, eliminating earmarks, eliminating soft money, do they make elected representatives, let's say in the House of Representatives, more in line with the actual political and voting attitudes of the constituents in their district who elected them?
Possibly, but it's so hard to say because it makes them more responsive to certain very vocal minorities of the constituents that elected them. And it gives outsized influence to certain people. You know, certainly if you are a Tea Party member and you have a Tea Party representative, you know, who represents your district, then certainly you are better represented than you were before. But if you're not a Tea Party member in that district, I would argue you're less well represented. And I would argue that that's less democratic. You know, you should be a representative for the entire district, everyone in your district, even people that didn't vote for you. But when you're more concerned about, you know, what Heritage Action or FreedomWorks is going to do to you in a Republican primary, then you're only really speaking to a tiny segment of your constituents and not, you know, trying to appeal to all of them. So, yeah, I don't think it's more democratic, although I can understand why some people think that.
Right. I mean, and I might have to talk to a political scientist on this, but it does seem like, you know, let's take Ted Yoho, right? Ted Yoho thinks that going through the debt ceiling would be fine and it would actually be beneficial for the world economy. It doesn't seem all that, from some of the polls I've read at least, it doesn't seem all that out of bounds that a majority or at least a plurality of Ted Yoho's constituents also believe that to be the case. So, and if he's just following, you know, the plurality of his constituents, or at least the ones who are highly politically engaged, who are much more likely to vote for him, if they're the ones, you know, writing letters to him, if they're the ones he's talking to at town halls, and if John Boehner can't buy him off with earmarks, that seems to me to be more democratic, right?
Well, maybe. But the flip side of that is, you know, we have a representative democracy. We don't have a direct democracy, and that's right. For a reason. The idea is that, you know, your lawmakers can be experts, they can at least be informed by experts, and they can make decisions that are, you know, necessary and sometimes difficult. And I think the debt ceiling is a perfect example of that. You know, this is a case where it's misunderstood by a lot of people, and it polls poorly because, you know, who wants to increase the debt limit? Who wants more debt? But it's necessary, and anybody, you know, if you study it for even 5 minutes, you understand that. So I think that's a case where, you know, sometimes you do need to maybe disregard, you know, popular sentiment. But on the flip side of that, what about something like universal background checks, which poll at, you know, 90% support, but the intensity level of the people who support it is way less than the intensity level of the people who don't support it. So you have a situation where we don't have universal background checks. We may never, because a tiny minority is so outsized in their activity that they can essentially veto the vast majority. You know, that's, I think, a distortion of democracy.
Right. I would say that is a case where, and that's a really good example, the American political system, I think, more than some other ones, says that intensity of belief matters, right? Yeah. In Australia, everyone has to vote. There's a law that says everyone has to vote, which basically, it tries to take that intensity question out of it. So if everyone has to vote, this guy who is kind of lukewarm on politics is still being heard. Whereas in America, you don't have to vote, you don't have to write letters, and the loudest voices sometimes get heard the most. And I think that right. It's probably up for debate if that's a good thing or not. But on that universal background checks question. Obviously, you know, 90% of people might be lukewarmly positive towards having that universal background checks legislation, but 10% of the people, that is the only thing they care about, you know? And right. So the American political system is kind of set up so that those 10% are heard in that case over the 90%.
Right. And I think that in theory is a good thing. You know, intensity is important and it should matter to some degree, but I think getting rid of earmarks, getting rid of parties, you know, allowing for outside groups like Heritage Action or all these groups that score votes to become more prominent and have more power has, you know, added leverage to those vocal minorities. And I think things have gotten out of whack and has given too much power to the intensity weighted intensity too much as opposed to kind of just sheer representation, sheer numbers.
Yeah, that could be the case. One of my favorite quotes about politics is from H.L. Mencken, and he said that, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, democracy is the theory that people know what's best for them and they deserve to get it good and hard. and I think that in a lot of cases, and I think that the good government reforms have largely made that more true, right? That, John Boehner can't buy off Ted Yoho to go against what might be the will of his constituents on the debt ceiling. So, you know what? They get a representative who is willing to plunge the world economy into chaos.
Right.
But that's what American democracy kind of incentivizes, maybe, at this point.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Churchill, which is, you know, democracy is a terrible form of government. It's just the best one we've come up with
right.
so far. Yeah. But I think there are cases like that. Like, let's take the Ted Yoho example, where it's incumbent upon leaders to not only be responsive to what their constituents want, but to also educate their constituents in places where they, you know, might not understand or might not get it. Maybe Ted Yoho's constituents genuinely understand the issue and genuinely don't want the debt ceiling raised. I doubt that. It's possible, but I doubt that. I think, you know, a more responsible approach, and this is not going to happen from Ted Yoho, but from other leaders, would be to explain to your constituents why we need to do this. And the American people are smart. They often don't have time to, you know, delve into policy details. But if you explain it to them, they'll understand it. But so much of political messaging these days assumes that people are dumb and can't be trusted to, like, be given the real facts and to really understand things and, you know, understand issues on their merits, so they're just distorted for partisan gain. And that happens on both sides, but I think it happens more on the right on issues like the debt ceiling, where everyone agrees that this is a terrible thing if we go over it, but because it's too difficult to educate people, you're just going to say, oh, it's actually not that big of a deal. Or maybe they believe it, I don't know, but more education in general, I think, is needed.
I would not disagree with that. Why don't we leave that there for today? But thanks a lot for coming on and chatting with me about the craziness going on in D.C. right now.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right. See you guys next time.